Sandra Cisneros went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop to study poetry, but she found herself writing vignettes inspired by her childhood in Chicago. Those vignettes became The House on Mango Street. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, our October book club, The House on Mango Street. Author Sandra Cisneros will be here to talk about what inspired this groundbreaking book that shows us the world through the eyes of a first-generation Mexican-American girl in Chicago. Two expert readers will also join the conversation, Tamara Boberf LaFontaine of Grinnell College and IPR's own Cassidy Arena, a reporter who covers Iowa's Latino and Spanish-speaking communities. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation iCORE Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Welcome to the October meeting of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros is told from the perspective of Esperanza Cordero. She is a first-generation Mexican-American girl on the cusp of womanhood growing up in Chicago. The book was published in 1984. It is beloved by readers of all ages, and it has become a classic. It has sold more than 6 million copies. It's been translated into over 20 languages, and it's taught in classrooms ranging from grade school to college. Sandra Cisneros is a poet, short story writer, novelist, and essayist. She has received many awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship and the National Medal of Arts. And this book, The House on Mango Street, had its beginning in Iowa, where she attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop in Iowa City. She is a dual citizen of Mexico and the United States, and we are so honored that she is with us today from her home in San Miguel de Allende. Sandra Cisneros, welcome to the show.
Hi, call me Sandra.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you so much for joining us. Sorry about the technological problems today, but we are so honored that you're willing to take the time to talk with us and to share your book with us.
Well, it's thrilling for me because you know I went to school in Iowa City. So it's great to be back.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back. And I'm wondering, could you start us off this hour by reading just a selection from the book? Many of our listeners will have read The House on Mango Street, but it's new to many listeners as well. Could you read an excerpt and introduce us?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this is a chapter called The Three Sisters that first line came to me in a dream. And so I used it. You know, you can't plagiarize when you dream.
The Three Sisters. They came with the wind that blows in August, thin as a spider web and barely noticed. Three who did not seem to be related to anything but the moon. One with laughter like tin, and one with eyes of a cat, and one with hands like porcelain. The ants, the three sisters, las comadres, they said. The baby died, Lucy and Rachel's sister. One night, a dog cried, and the next day a yellow bird flew in through an open window. Before the week was over, the baby's fever was worse. Then Jesus came and took the baby with him far away. That's what their mother said. Then the visitors came, in and out of the little house. It was hard to keep the floors clean. Anybody who had ever wondered what color the walls were came and came to look at that little thumb of a human in a box like candy. I had never seen the dead before, not for real, not in somebody's living room for people to kiss and bless themselves and light a candle for, not in a house. It seemed strange. They must have known, the sisters. They had the power and could sense what was what. They said, "Come here," and gave me a stick of gum. They smelled like Kleenex or the inside of a satin handbag, and then I didn't feel afraid. "What's your name?" the cat-eyed one asked. Esperanza, I said. Esperanza, the old blue-veined one repeated in a high, thin voice. Esperanza, a good, good name. My knees hurt, the one with the funny laugh complained. Tomorrow it will rain. Yes, tomorrow, they said. How do you know? I asked. We know.
That's Sandra Cisneros reading just a little bit from The House on Mango Street. And before we delve into the book, I do want to go back to your time at the University of Iowa. You came to Iowa City to study at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and you came to study poetry. But while you were writing poetry, you also started writing these vignettes that were inspired by your childhood in Chicago. Tell me about that.
Now, you know, I had always written poetry and fiction, but I had never formally been in a workshop with a fiction writer. I never have. I just trained with a poet. So when it came time for me to choose which citizen I would be, a citizen of the country of poetry, the country of fiction, I had more poetry under my belt. So that's why I applied for the poetry workshop. And when I got here, a difficult time in the poetry workshop. And it wasn't until my second semester, the beginning of 1977, that I started writing House on Mango Street as my life raft. I wasn't making any headway with the poetry. I was centering myself and feeling disconnected with the workshop, and writing fiction helped me to keep my spirit alive, even though I didn't write the book for my thesis. It was just something I wrote on the side. I did share it with some of my poetry teachers, but it was not anything I would get any credit for.
So
this was my life raft.
It was keeping you afloat while you were dealing with...
Because I felt lost in the poetry workshop, and the things I wrote about were in a voice that weren't mine. But when I began House, I had to search for what I knew that no one else in my class knew. And it forced me to go into my past, to an earlier voice, to an earlier shame, to an early neighborhood. And that's how House began. I talk about it more in depth in the introduction. I encourage everyone to read it. I like to say that the introduction is longer than the book.
It is not actually longer than the book, but it's a lovely introduction, and it takes us back to the woman who wrote this book, the woman you were in those moments. And I also recommend that anyone spend some time reading that. I want to ask you, and we're going to talk a great deal more about the importance of representation in art and literature. And it sounds like you really needed to express your identity through your art. That was something that was incredibly important to you while you were going through the workshop. Your book has become, for many, many women and girls, the first time they really see themselves in literature. Did you have a touchstone from your childhood where you felt like you saw yourself reflected in art?
You know, when I was a young girl, my favorite books were always books that had a girl protagonist. So, you know, I loved Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and The Fairy Tales of Hans Christian Andersen, and I still love those books. But I didn't realize how disconnected I was at the workshop because I am a woman, a daughter of immigrants, and because of the neighborhood I came from, a dangerous neighborhood in Chicago, one that City Hall forgot. And I didn't think of myself as having that border because of gender yet. I didn't have that consciousness. It's almost as if through Esperanza, I was able to uncensor myself, and using an earlier voice, I could explore the route that a young woman inherits. So I needed that to find my politics, to find my direction, even though I wasn't aware that's what I was doing. I was just reacting. I was coming from some place of rage when I began the book. I wanted to write something where no one could tell me I was wrong. That's how I felt. I was so angry at the poetry workshop I was in. I said, I just want to write something where I'm the expert. And of course, when you look at and ask yourself, what do I know that no one else in this room knows? You're going to stumble on your voice. So without knowing it, that's the route I took.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Sandra Cisneros. Her book, The House on Mango Street, first published in 1984, is our selection for the October Talk of Iowa Book Club. We also have with us one of our expert readers right now, Tamara Beaubœuf-LaFontaine, a professor and the Louise R. Noun Chair in Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies at Grinnell College. Our other expert reader, IPR's own Cassidy Arena, will be joining us in just a moment, and you are welcome to join the conversation as well. Is this a book that means something to you? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation iCORE training program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the October meeting of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. And the book we're talking about today is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. The book is told from the perspective of Esperanza Cordero. She is a first-generation Mexican-American girl growing up in Chicago that she shares with the author, Sandra Cisneros. And the early parts of this book were written in Iowa City. When Cisneros was attending the Iowa Writers' Workshop, she came to study poetry, but this beautiful, beautiful novel that has now become a classic came out of those days at the Writers' Workshop. She is on the line with me now. Sandra Cisneros, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, crystal clear. That's a wonderful improvement. Right. Also with us, we have Tamara Beaubœuf-LaFontaine. She is professor and the Louise R. Noun Chair in Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies at Grinnell College. She has been teaching this book this semester. Tamara, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here and part of the conversation.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to, before we get into the discussion, I want to ask you, why did you choose to teach this book?
Oh, for many reasons. So it's a classic, as you mentioned. It's a lovely novel, and it's important. And one thing that I've tried to do in this course, which is called Growing Up Girl, is to remind our students that girlhood is much broader than we tend to think about it. And Ms. Cisneros has this lovely short story where she talks about how she is positioned as a girl growing up in this urban area of Chicago versus people who live on the hills, you know, who live so close to the stars that they forget people like us who are on the ground. And so much of my teaching of this book was to help my students remember a broader range of girlhoods, including girls who don't get talked about a lot.
And when did you first encounter this book?
That's an excellent question. I think it's probably 20 years ago, in my 20s, late 20s, early 30s.
And what was your first impression? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think it's still the impression I have. Every time I read it, I am taken back to being a 12-year-old myself. So when I read this book, I think of Esperanza as a diarist, someone who is chronicling a year in her life as a pre-adolescent, and I think that's really important. And I see each of these chapters as an entry recording something important, something that she's noticed, something that she wants to not forget. And so that's still the lens to which I look at this and enjoy this novel.
Well, Tamara, thank you so much for being with us. And I also want to bring our other expert reader into the conversation now, Iowa Public Radio's own Cassidy Arena. She's a reporter who covers Iowa's Latino and Spanish-speaking communities. Cassidy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I was talking earlier with Tamara about when she first encountered this book. You encountered it as a very young girl. Tell me when you first read The House on Mango Street.
Yeah, so I first read the book in elementary school when our librarian would take a random book for the week and she would read out loud to us an excerpt a little bit like what Sandra just did. And then that prompted me to actually just rent the book out and check the book out, excuse me, and read the entire thing.
So you were in fourth grade, you think, at the time?
I was around that age. You know, it all goes in a blur, but right. That's about right.
Do you remember what your reaction was?
Well, the first thing I pointed out to my little fourth grade self was that I had just been used to reading about Junie B. Jones and a lot of books where I guess I didn't really fully relate to them. It was something that I didn't really think was anything wrong. But when I read this book, there was a lot of things that I was like, oh, yeah, I totally get that. Or, oh, right, because that's just normal.
So you saw yourself, you are a second generation American, but you saw yourself in a way in this book that you hadn't really been able to see yourself before you fell?
Oh, for sure. There were a lot of things, for instance, the excerpt that was read a little bit earlier in the hour about the three sisters and a little bit of that voodoo practice that came out was something that was very familiar to me in my own family. A lot of superstitions, a lot of kind of impractical magic sort of stuff that seemed pretty regular to me, but maybe not so to all of the other little fourth graders around.
Well, and I have to ask you, now as a woman in your 20s, coming back and rereading the book, were there surprises for you?
Definitely. It's kind of that thing where you go back and watch a movie and you realize you missed all of these adult jokes that were in the movie that now you get. So a lot of the situations that Esperanza was going through kind of went over my head at first. For instance, a lot of the sexual awakening and growing up stuff that I didn't fully get until now.
Well, and Tamara, I know in teaching this book in your class, your students, many of them had encountered the book when they were young as well. Either they had had part of it taught to them in middle school or high school and then were coming back to it. How did your students react to coming back to the book as adults?
Yeah, I think coming back to it, they were really interested in her age, you know, being about age 12. And recalling that that's a really consequential moment for many of them. So I think about half of my students had read it in elementary and usually middle school. And recognizing that if they think about their 12-year-old self and then their like 18-year-old self, there's often a pretty marked difference, but it's a difference that they often forget. So when Sandra Cisneros just earlier was saying that she utilized Esperanza to acquire an earlier voice that she had, that process is something that my students remarked on, you know? So when they would hear Esperanza, they're like, yeah, I remember having these thoughts. I remember doing these things. I remember wanting, you know, whatever. And how come I don't remember that now? I have to be reminded of it. So that was the shift that they spoke a lot about.
Well, and Sandra, you talked about starting to write this book. And of course, it didn't happen overnight. You spent about 6 years writing the book. Did you think about the audience that would read this book when you were writing it?
Well, when I began it, no. I was blocked, and you know how we often censor ourselves? I felt censored writing in poetry, so this was an ability for me to finally find my voice to speak, even if it was only on paper. And it wasn't until later that I started thinking about who would read this. When I was teaching in the Mexican-American community, and you know, I was teaching high school students, and I started adopting them as characters in my landscape of my childhood. And by then, I knew I wanted to write something that they could read, that bus drivers could read, that housewives like my mom with seven kids could read. So by then, I was more conscious of the reader.
Well, and when this book was published in 1984, and you started to hear from people who were connecting with the book, tell me what you heard and what helped you realize how it was connecting with people.
Well, you have to remember, when we write something, it takes many, many years, sometimes decades, before we hear from the readers. It's like we put a note in a bottle and toss it out into the sea. And so those stories that I wrote in my 20s, I didn't really start understanding what I'd done until about the time I was 40. I planted some seeds, and I didn't see that harvest till I was 40.
Well, I'm so grateful that we've all gotten to partake in this harvest. And I want to talk to about some of the themes that we see in this book. It's not a traditional novel narrative. There is not even really a narrative thread that pulls us through the book, but there are a series of vignettes, and they're all told from the same perspective, and we get a different insight into both the life of Esperanza, but of her family members, of the people on the street. And Tamara, I would love for you to lead us off in thinking about really the perspective that Esperanza shares, because I know you've been teaching this book with regard to girlhood, and she does have such a unique young female perspective.
Yeah, she does. And her positioning at the edge of both girlhood and adolescence. So she's older than her little sister, Nenny, and she comments on that. But she's also younger than some of her girlfriends. And she just has this beautiful vantage point where she is trying to figure out, what kind of woman will I become, you know, from the models that she has. And so one of my favorite stories is Four Skinny Trees. So to me, the through line is Esperanza trying to figure out what it means to be her. And I really see the book as sort of responding to the first story. So the first story is called, I think, the House on Mango Street. And in it, you know, there's a lot of disappointment. This family has moved into a home that is not their dream home. And then there's this nun character who points out, says to Esperanza, you live there. And there's such sort of disappointment and disdain. And the way I read the book, and I think the way a lot of the students came to see it, is that this is Esperanza's response over many chapters to why the nun is wrong and how she saw the space of Mango Street as this place that didn't have value. And so as Esperanza goes through, I think she puts she gives feeling to a lot of things that people misrepresent. She brings out the lives of the women and the girls around her, women who experience a lot of sexual violence, and that's called out. But there's also real beauty and artistry that is also a key point of all of these narratives. And I think what I hear and what my students and I talked about is how Esperanza develops into a writer because of these women. It's not the nuns at school who encourage her. It's these women who say, read your poem to me again, or read this story, or let me tell you what I think about, or who, as in the story that that Sandra has read an excerpt of, affirm her vision of self. And so to me, this is a beautiful counter narrative to the disparaging tone that, you know, certain girls are at risk and nothing of value will come from them. And I think that was something very powerful in our conversations in my class.
Sandra, what would you like to add to that? There are people I know who think that this is an autobiographical book. There are autobiographical elements, but you've made it very clear that it is not an autobiography. But when you think about Esperanza and what she sees, can you respond to what Tamara was saying?
Yeah, well, you know, I was in Iowa and I didn't have my voice. I lost my voice in the workshop. So this was a way for me to comment on the world with an earlier self, an earlier place, with an autobiographical shame about my neighborhood, my poverty, the people I knew. But in writing it, I discovered the richness of that neighborhood. And as I gathered the stories from my students, I started realizing this is what I want to be, this is what I do not want through Esperanza's voice. I started discovering my politics, my feminism, my roots as a working class woman, as the daughter of an immigrant. You know, all these things came to the fore, but they didn't come out from my head. They came from my heart.
Esperanza has such incredible insight as an observer of the women in her neighborhood. She sees things that other people don't see. Sandra, do you feel that that is something that you were able to do as a young girl? Or was that something that came from a perspective that was gained with time?
You know, when you're a girl, you're invisible. Especially if you're a Mexican girl. You know, you're in the room and people are talking around you. So I felt as if I was a spy in the house of my family and in the house of the university because I didn't speak, because I had such low self-esteem about what I had to say. I was often silent. I was a witness. And listening is very good training for being a writer. So I think that House on Mongo Street allowed me to find my voice, literally, helped me find my writing voice, helped me find my direction and what I wanted, because women in their 20s, you know, we always inherit what we want. We aren't asked what we want in life. We are told by church and state. And the book allowed me freedom to invent the protagonist's life, but also my own.
So you were taking...
I wanted to be a mom.
You were taking...
I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to mother books.
And you were taking in all of those things that you observed as that silent, invisible girl.
Yeah, I never know what I think till I write it down.
Cassidy, tell me about your perspective on this. Again, having read it as a young girl yourself and then coming back to it now, things have changed a lot, but this does jive in some ways with your experience growing up as well, right?
Yeah, something that really came to my mind reading it through a second time, like this one word, validation. So basically, Esperanza is going through all of these... in between worlds of, okay, she has her own culture here, but then she's also has to go to school and she has her friends who maybe don't always understand what she's going through, the nuns who don't understand what she's going through. And so she's caught in between these two worlds that really resonated with me. For example, one of my favorite sections was the My Name story, when she's talking about her name. Esperanza is something that's really hard for English speakers to say, but it's beautiful in Spanish. And that's something that I know like so well, except it's the other way around. So my name is Cassidy. It's a really hard name for my own family to say. So usually they actually don't even call me by my full name. Yet in the English world, it's an easy name. So I definitely understand being caught in between two worlds. And after reading this book for the second time, I realize it's not something that only I am going through. And it's something, a situation that is really resonates with a lot of other young women as well.
Well, and you're saying that as a second generation American, your parents gave you a very American name. Did that make you feel pushed away from your culture at all?
Oh, growing up, I always wanted a name like Gabriela or Alessandra or something. And so it's something that on the outside, I look like I'm Spanish, and yet my name is a very English name. So it's one thing that I kind of wished that I could have to myself that would be different from a lot of my other students. So if I had a really Spanish name, that would almost be an excuse for why I look the way I look.
Oh, interesting. Well, and Sandra, I think one of the things that is really beautiful about the book is, again, Esperanza is seeing so much and understanding so much. She has a perspective that a lot of the people in her neighborhood and the nuns at school clearly don't share, but we trust her. Tell me how you think about that. I mean, she is a very reliable narrator, even though she's a young girl.
I wouldn't know. I'm just the author. You know, I just dreamed the dream, and you tell me what my dream meant.
Is this a little surreal to listen to people telling you what your dream meant?
No, I love it. I love it. It's like going to see the wise neighbor lady.
Well, tomorrow then I'll toss that question to you. Esperanza feels very trustworthy, which is not something that we're necessarily taught to expect from a 12-year-old girl.
No, but I think a lot of girls know that they are trustworthy. I think they're very careful observers. I mean, they're developmental psychologists who have talked about what girls know and will speak up about until about the age of adolescence. So this rings true. And I think there's a whole literature of women's writing that starts autobiographically, and it often begins in pre-adolescence. You know, these characters who call things as they are, And I think it's because as a girl, they are not quite adults and they are critical of the adult world. It doesn't make sense to them. And I think that's the beauty of Esperanza's voice is that, you know, when she sees violence, you know, she says this is not right. And she doesn't have an investment in justifying it. And I think that's such a helpful perspective to have. And so I think we need a lot of girl narrators. And I just wonder, like, if we listen to girls, what would we think differently about, you know? If we looked at people that we think are, that we make invisible, like, what would they show us? And I think they would show us things such as when Esperanza talks about her namesake and this woman who was basically captured by her husband, what Esperanza reminds us of is that she was a fierce woman, you know? And so these girls are really attuned to these stories that make more sense to them because they know women are more than the sort of small characters they become over time.
And we're,
you know,
going to take artistry. We'll pick this up in just a moment because there's so much more to discuss there. We are talking about The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. It's our October pick for the Talk of Iowa Book Club. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the October meeting of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. The book this month is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. It was first published in 1984, and it has become a classic, a coming-of-age classic. It's told from the perspective of Esperanza Cordero. She is a first-generation Mexican-American girl growing up in Chicago. With me this hour is the author of the book, Sandra Cisneros, and the beginnings of this book were written in Iowa City when she was attending the Iowa Writers' Workshop studying poetry, although she found herself writing these vignettes that would several years later become part of the novel. With me as well, we have a couple of expert readers. Tamara Boberf LaFontaine is a professor and the Louise R. Noun Chair in Gender and Women's and Sexuality Studies at Grinnell College. She has been teaching the book this semester. Cassidy Arena is an Iowa Public Radio reporter who covers Iowa's Latino and Spanish-speaking communities. She first read this book as a fourth grader and has read it again as a woman in her 20s and is bringing that perspective to us today. And Tamara, I had to cut you off before the break. We were talking about, again, some of what Esperanza sees in the women in her community, in her neighborhood. And I think you were about to bring up one of my favorite parts of the novel, which is when she's talking with her mother, and the chapter is called A Smart Cookie. She's talking with her mother, and her mother tells her a little bit about herself, you know, about what she could have done and what she could have been if circumstances had been different. She can see so much more in the women in her neighborhood than others can see. Tamara, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's her strength as a narrator, is she shows how woefully underestimated so many of the people around her are, you know, so including her mother, including herself, including a lot of her friends, her father. And I think what she does is that she humanizes these individuals by showing us the things that we don't know or the things that we wouldn't assume, you know, that her mom had artistic leanings, you know, that her mom could excel, but was shamed by her own poverty. But her mom is also someone who keeps love alive in the house. So there's this beautiful description early on where Esperanza describes the smell of her mother's hair and how she loves cozying up with her mom. And so there's such a, you know, I think the first chapter almost sets up that, you know, Mango Street is drab. And as you go through the novel, I think there's such color that comes through in these loving portraits of these people around her. And I think that makes her reliable because, you know, people are not one-dimensional, you know. So by bringing in their unique qualities and their aspirations and their hopes, we come up with a full feeling of what this Mango Street is and why it has supported her in her quest to become her own person and a writer.
And why it will always be a part of her. And Sandra, you write in the introduction about some of the expectations that you were facing and the expectations that you had to push back against to be able to become a writer. Do you see that push and pull in Esperanza as well?
Well, you know, in my own life, you know, I had to struggle just to go to school at the University of Iowa because it was the first time I was moving away from home. And it was a real struggle with my father, who expected me to, I could study. He expected that. possibly, but he wanted me to go to college to find a husband. So he was really disappointed when I left college with no husband and then graduate school with no husband. You know, but I was looking for my freedom, and I wanted to get out of my under my father's roof and find my own direction and travel and do things that writers do. I didn't know how to become a writer, but I was trying awfully hard. I didn't know any writers except the ones that I would meet at the University of Iowa. And a lot of them were not great models of what I wanted to become. I think my friendship with my classmate, Joy Harjo, who's now the poet laureate, was probably the most significant encounter I had at Iowa. You know, she was a little bit older than me. She already had two children. She had a pickup truck. She knew how to drive. You know, I looked up to her, and she helped me to find my path as a woman of color, as a woman from a working class neighborhood. You know, she was the one, without realizing it, that was holding light up to the path that I would take. And she also understood my reluctance to speak in class and my fear. So it was great to have at least one person that I could open my heart to. I had a few other friends, but not many. As far as women friends, I think Joy was it. So that was relevant. And I didn't know at the time that I was creating a book that would be read and be relevant even now in 2020. That's the sad part, that it's the problems that I wrote about in 1977 are even more relevant now when we talk about women having control over their own lives, about gentrification, about people we look at as other, about silencing those people we look at as other. You know, there's a time in American history where I've never seen the country so divided. And I hope people will look at House on Mungo Street as a book that's not just about a young girl, but about their own neighborhoods, their own responsibility as citizens, as community members for improving the ills that they see. Because ultimately, the house on Mungo Street is about the house in your spirit, about finding that place you belong. And that house in the spirit may be the United States. It's really about our own responsibilities. Are we voting? Are we out there protesting? Are we out there speaking? Do we have a voice? And so, like it or not, this is a book for 2020. And I am only aware of its deep relevance now because I'm working on House on Mungo Street, the opera, with Derek Bermel, and I'm working on developing these characters even more, giving them dialogue. I'm writing the libretto. So it's a story I wrote when I was alone and had no voice. And now, as I'm 65 years old, on the point of turning 66 at the end of this year, it's a book that I find is allowing people who have no voice, whether you're a woman or a mom or a person new to this country or a person who has lived here 13 generations, it's speaking to many, many people. It's not just a Chicago neighborhood. It's a neighborhood of many kinds of people and many kinds of problems. And I wanted to write about it with love so you could see the beauty of that community as well.
Cassidy, I want to bring you in here because you just graduated from college. You're a 2020 graduate from college, and here you are, beginning your career and doing exceptional work. And you find the kind of push and pull that Sandra was writing about in her introduction, and that Sandra was talking about. You were expected to go to school, you were expected to study, but are you defying expectations in this moment by pursuing what you studied?
Yes, so my grandparents came from Cuba, and my great-grandmother actually didn't even finish elementary school. So education has always been somewhat of a classy thing to have, and it's really a privilege to have. So that's something that my family has always pushed me to do, is get your education. It's something that nobody can take away from you. But on the flip side, it's a completely different situation that I'm actually using my education and living on my own as a single person is something that's very scary for them. And like Sandra was saying, you know, I don't have a husband. I am working on my own. And even to this day, my own mother, who is into her 40s, has been told by my bisabuela, my great-grandmother, that she should really be staying home to take care of her children. So it's just something that another example of how these two cultures kind of clash.
Well, and Sandra, I know that you were going beyond that and talking about the relevance of this moment, but it strikes me that, you know, listening to Cassidy's response, it is exactly as relevant as it was in exactly the same ways, really, as when you wrote it.
Yes, and not just for Latina women, but for white women too. A lot of our parents expect the daughters to have families in their 20s and then the pressure to have grandchildren. That's always there. So I think the book is for everyone.
Well, and that's something that we've talked about on this program with rural cultures in Iowa. A lot of women go to college and go off to pursue that career. But again, with their parents and their grandparents in rural Iowa, have a hard time understanding why they want to live in such a way that is so different. And I want to talk, before we run out of time, I want to talk about how very vulnerable Esperanza and her female friends are in this book. And when I first talked to you about the book and learned that you read this in fourth grade, I was a little bit surprised that someone handed it to an elementary school student, because there are these moments that really show the vulnerability of these girls. There are sexual predators. There is rape. There is molestation. There is danger here. So as an adult woman reading this book, were you somewhat surprised to find this?
Yes, it's something that as I was reading, it really made me sad. And the reason why is because, as I talked about before, is I really saw myself, I really saw my family within this book. So as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, oh, there's Tia Yolanda, oh, there's my cousin Adrian. And then realizing that these short stories were, there is violence and there is aggression also applied to many aspects in my own family. So it was something that was a little bit hard to read because it really put context to a lot of the things that happened within my own family.
Well, and Tamara, your students, a lot of them read this when they were in middle school or high school. Did they miss a lot of that? Was this a surprise to a lot of them?
Yeah, I think a lot of there was a curated read of the book. So I think there were chapters that were avoided or glossed over, or if you've experienced something like this. So I think the sexualized violence wasn't named. It was kind of like, we'll refer you to somebody you can talk to. So there's a lot of evasion there. So I think in rereading it, my students were sort of, I don't want to say impressed, but they were like, wow, Sandra Cisneros has captured something that we all know exists. And that's the whole thing, I think, in this book. What's so powerful, and it's maybe heartbreaking too, is that this underground where girls know things that people don't believe they can know, where girls experience things that are horrific, that underground persists, you know? And so that's something that I think a lot of my students could recognize, and I think they really valued. So I'm thinking of one in particular. And she says that it's not the point that authorities were told, you know, in any of these instances, is that you have this book that has enduring value that says these things happen and they're not right. You know, it calls out the violence. And I think that's quite a political move that's still, unfortunately, really needed.
Yeah. Well, Sandra, of course, the threat of sexual violence is something that all women live with, but it is, you know, young girls, women and girls living in poverty are particularly vulnerable. In writing about that and publishing that in 1984, I can imagine that was really groundbreaking at the time. Was there a pushback against that in the book?
I know that there have been a couple of cases where the book has been banned, but I wrote it in such a way, such a poetic way, that if you weren't a mature enough human being, you wouldn't understand what was going on. I wanted to make sure that I could read these out loud in front of children and I would not upset offend the teachers. So I was very conscious of perhaps children being in the room. And since I am a poet, I was able to write around it.
You walked that line beautifully. I mean, Cassidy is the perfect example of that. That's exactly your experience, right, Cassidy?
Exactly.
So we only have a couple of minutes left here. And recently, I have a 15-year-old daughter at home. And so I often read the same books that she reads. And while I was reading The House on Mango Street, I also was reading a young adult novel that was just published recently. It's called Clap When You Land by Elizabeth Acevedo. And that's a beautiful coming-of-age novel. It's written in verse, actually. And it felt like the grandchild of your book, The House on Mango Street, in so many ways. Sandra, are you aware of the incredible legacy that this book has? You have inspired so many writers and so many readers.
Yes, but so many writers that have inspired me. I think the mother of my book would be Gwendolyn Brooks, Maud Martha, the poet from Chicago. And even though I wasn't aware of her book until after I wrote mine, she's still a literary ancestor because I was influenced by her poetry before I discovered her prose. And later I would discover Elena Poniatowska, the Grand Dame of Mexican Letters, and her story cycle, Lilus Kikus. And these books came to me after House, but they are still related to House.
How does it feel to you that people are still picking up this book today and you're still reaching young girls and teenagers and women and men with these words?
Well, I feel humbled, honored, and I still feel my best work is ahead of me. So I'm very happy that people love my first child. But I'm working on House on Mango Street, the opera. I'm working on being a consultant for House on Mango Street, the television show. I'm working on poetry. I'm working on short stories. I have many, many projects ahead of me.
Well, we're so excited about that. And when do you think we'll be introduced to the House on Mango Street, the opera?
Well, I'm on draft 6, so we're working as fast as we can.
Well, Sandra Cisneros, thank you so much for being part of this today.
Thank you, Tamara and La Cassidy. If you lived in Texas, you'd be La Cassidy and you would fit right in.
Perfect.
Sandra Cisneros is the author of The House on Mango Street, our expert readers today. Cassidy Arena, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Iowa Public Radio's Cassidy Arena is a reporter who covers Iowa's Latino and Spanish-speaking communities. And also with us today, Tamara Beaubourg LaFontaine, a professor and the Louise R. Noun Chair in Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies at Grinnell College. Tamara, thank you so much.
This was fabulous. Thank you again.
And of course, the Talk of Iowa Book Club continues next month, so please join us for the next installation of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. It's time to read a little Wallace Stegner for that session, and we have a selection every month. You can find out more about it on our website, iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.